With the pre-council meeting, Mr. Manager?
Well, we have two basic items on tonight. One, we'd like to share the results of our health impact assessment, our first one. And we've got the real experts here to present, and then we'll shift gears and move into the beginning of our annual conversation about the meet and confer process with our representative groups who are here tonight. So, Stephanie, would you kick us off?
Sure. I'm going to introduce you to the real experts. So I just want to compliment the staff that are going to do this for you tonight, because this is the first health impact assessment for Columbia and Boone County. It's one of the first in the state of Missouri. I think there's been one other one done over in the St. Louis area, and so this is really sort of new work that is happening in public health more in other countries, but growingly in this country, and we're excited to be a part of it. So I'm going to introduce you to Jason Wilcox, who's our health impact assessment coordinator, and Rachel Young, who is our health impact assessment communications coordinator or specialist, and then also, since Rachel's going to be leaving us in the next few months, we have Kate McIntyre, who will be taking her place. She's sitting over there. So the whole crew's here, and you really have the experts that have really done the yeoman's work, and they're going to give you the information. So come on up.
Well, thank you, Stephanie, for that introduction, and thank you to Council for having us here tonight. Just running through the agenda really quickly, we just want to do a quick introduction on the Columbia Transit System Health Impact Assessment Project, just so why we're here this evening. Do a quick overview of what a health impact assessment is, and then present our key findings and recommendations to the council. So the funding we received through the project was through the Missouri Foundation for Health, and that grant was held by Central Missouri Community Action, and then also through the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, the Roadmaps grant, and that was held by the PedNet Coalition. Upon receiving those two grants, the two organizations partnered with the Public Health Department, and we created the Health Impact Assessment Partner Team. So we had representation from not only advocacy groups, but also community organizations, as well as local government.
So first, to define what a health impact assessment is, the tool is really based on our knowledge that health is influenced by all sorts of policies not just in the health domain, but also in education and transportation or in planning. The process is one of gathering the best available evidence to try to determine what the likely health impacts will be from a proposed policy, plan, or project. The key points being that it's not an advocacy process, it's an evidence and research-based process, gathering, again, the best available evidence. And then that the health impact assessment is conducted before the policy or program is enacted, because the primary goal is to be able to provide recommendations on how the policy might be able to be altered to maximize benefits to health and mitigate ill effects. So again, some of the benefits of the health impact assessment process, and we saw this demonstrated in our first health impact assessment. Jason mentioned we had a broad coalition of groups who came together to work on the health impact assessment. In conducting the assessment, we also were able to conduct conversations and gain input from stakeholders, including decision makers, some people at the table there, as well as community members. An additional benefit of the process is that increases the consideration of health in decision making. So, health being a primary goal of ours as a community to improve the health and well-being of Columbians, health impact assessment gives us a way to bring that conversation to other policy considerations.
And our objective for the demonstration grant was to demonstrate potential of HIA to positively influence the citizens of Columbia and Boone County's health by first conducting a pilot health impact assessment, and that was done on the Columbia Transit System. We'll be performing another health impact assessment this year on a yet-to-be-identified topic. And then our second goal was to initiate discussions with government stakeholders on the potential to sustain health impact assessment after the grants have run out later this year. So health impact assessment has really taken off in the United States over the last 5 years or so, so it's been a really interesting tool to work with. So we met, our HIA partner team met back in May, and we looked at how we would expand Columbia Transit, the services. That was our goal. So we were looking at physical activity as one of the health indicators, exposure to the outdoors, accessibility to health care, employment, education, and healthy food options, as well as creation of a livable and sustainable community. So we actually went through and did a logic model with the group and picked the four main health health determinants to research.
So the data that we collected to help us understand how these health determinants would be impacted by potential expansions to transit, we looked at literature reviews, so large-scale studies that others had conducted to find the best available evidence linking those determinants to transit. And then we also conducted our own primary research. These are some of the demographics of a study that we conducted, a community-based study we conducted in partnership with CMCA. And we had some community members help us conducting the survey of transit users. We found that those who rode transit more frequently reported, they lacked cars, it's not a surprise, but they also had more difficulties in getting to healthcare, and they had reported missing work more because of transit difficulties. They also reported that they would likely to select a place to interview for employment and also a healthcare provider based on their proximity to the bus routes. In addition to this quantitative research, the numbers, we also conducted some qualitative research, some interviews with community members. We asked them what difficulties they found with using the transit service, what they liked about it, and then what improvements they would like to see to the service. And we're gonna show you a movie made up of some of those interview clips right now.
My name is Richmond Wheeler, and I live in Columbia, Missouri.
Once I ride the transit, I ride it to doctor's appointments, I ride it to go see friends, and I ride it to the grocery store.
I have a car right now. There have been times in my life, though, certainly over the last 20 years here in Columbia, where either my vehicle was broken down or for whatever reason I didn't have transportation. So I have used the transit system to get back and forth to work before.
I ride the bus back and forth to work, and grocery shopping, and to the hospital at times.
I use them to doctor's appointments and to getting around to where I need to get to school.
I use the bus to go to work and church and everywhere.
I was really surprised, actually, by how the buses were clean. The stop that we got onto the bus at was well maintained. The downtown bus station, the Wabash station, was very clean, and I mean everything about the system everything is very professional.
I like the cleanness of the buses now.
I think the drivers are nice.
I like it because they give me right at the front door of my job and to different stores and different areas in the community.
They're pretty much always on time.
I like that the bus drivers, they'll let you know your stops before you get there. You better call down there and they'll let you know where you need to get to and what bus you need to get to.
They're very friendly. They tell you where you need to get off at. They show you where you need, if you have a plate you can get off at. And they're very reliable people and very friendly.
The challenge I have with it is like when I have to work on Sundays, and especially when it's cold weather, I have to walk. And that put a burden on me.
I have had the job of case managing before, working with people who are trying to get back on their feet and get settled again when I worked at the domestic violence shelter here. And that could be very problematic for people who didn't have transportation. It eliminates the possibility of working evening jobs, especially if you're going to be working Monday, Tuesday, or Wednesday when the bus stops running at 6. And I've known plenty of women who got off their shift at someplace like Steak and Shake at 2 in the morning and they walked home. It's a bad situation for anybody.
I mean, 45 minutes in between buses, if they're all running on schedule. If you miss the bus, obviously the minimum that you're going to be off in your schedule is going to be 45 minutes.
They don't run long enough during the day, and they don't run all week.
I can see a lot of scenarios that people would get into where it was far faster to just walk the distance.
If I have to be somewhere and it only takes 15 minutes at my appointment, I would have to wait for a good 40 minutes before the next bus comes.
It's the timing of things, going to where they're going. So you're either at work 45 minutes early or you'd end up there 10 minutes late, which I know that can't be fine-tuned completely. But I think if we had more buses running more frequently, that wouldn't be a problem for people.
It just seems like there's an awful lot of planning that would have to take place for me to make using the bus anything other than a scheduled event. I mean, if it was something that I was going to take the exact same bus at the exact same time every single day to get to work and to get back, that's one thing that I can schedule ahead, but there's no way I can spontaneously decide that I'm going to take the bus.
The buses need to run every day, 7 days a week, because there's people that have to work and they don't have reliable transportation, and the times they need to run later because people get off work late and they don't have a way of getting home unless they walk or have to call somebody to come get them.
The bus stops needs to be actually indicated, you know, because they used to have signs every stop. Now they don't.
They don't have enough shelters for people that, you know, when it's cold weather or bad weather out, and you have to stand on the stop, be on the corner, you have to stand there in the weather.
Make improvements. I'd like to see more routes, more, you know, more buses on the routes and longer time frames. It should run, I would like to see it go around the clock. You know, that way people really could get, if you were working at the hospital and you got off late or just anywhere, you could actually use the bus to get around. It's not very feasible the way it is right now.
Let the buses run all day, 24 hours a day.
More buses, more frequently, smaller routes.
The whole thing is fixing windows. It needs to be fixed.
I work on Saturdays. We need hours, Saturday morning hours, for the bus service. I pay taxes. I think we do all deserve it.
Okay, so now we'll go into the key findings that we found through the health impact assessment. First one, we found that users accrue more physical activity by walking and riding to the bus. We found improved access to healthcare and employment and potential healthcare benefits through stress reduction. We also found improved access to healthy food options, especially for those people that are residents of food deserts. And we also found greater community cohesion specific regards to social capital. And our recommendations, so based on the physical activity research that we found, our first recommendation is to ensure bus routes that promote ridership in densely populated areas. Number two, promote collaboration between Columbia Transit and the Health Department, and this is specifically to produce social marketing materials based on physical activity that could be put up either at Wabash or on the buses. And then also ensure that there are bike racks at major Columbia Transit hubs, specifically the time points that are on the map. With exposure to the outdoors regarding parks and recreation activities, we recommend maximizing access to parks when new routes are designed, and also to post bus routes and timetables at parks that are currently being serviced by current bus routes.
You know from the literature and from our interviews that lack of transportation is a big barrier to accessing health care. Our recommendation is that access to health care, to the major hospitals, but also to clinics, pharmacies, other places that people need to maintain health, that's a major consideration, that buses are getting people to those places. We also found that a lot of people had difficulty if they worked non-traditional hours, not your typical 8 to 5, that it was difficult for them to use the bus to get to work, that it limited their employment opportunities. Using public transit to get to work, that's the main reason people do use public transit, and we think there's opportunities to for the service, the bus service we have, especially if we're able to expand it, to better serve employees and employers. We think that perhaps creating a group, a transit access to employment group, can help figure out what some of the barriers are in using transit to access work. And then also that perhaps someone from the business community should be representing that community in the Public Transit Advisory Commission. We also found that we know generally that the more education you have, the better your health is in general, but that lack of transportation is a limitation for people who are trying to get to classes that are sometimes held in the hours after the bus stops operating, such as adult education classes, GED classes at the Career Center or places such as that. We also know that being able to participate in after-school activities, transportation can be a big limitation in that kids who participate in after-school activities are sometimes shown to have better attendance, better behavior at school. So working with Columbia Public Schools to maybe provide transportation to students to those activities could be a benefit. We also know from some of the food asset mapping that was done, some other community resources, that people in neighborhoods classified as food deserts often are taking the bus to get to grocery stores. Expansion of hours, expansion to Sundays, or continuing that farmers market bus route, those are all ways that we could try to help people use public transit to have access to healthier food options.
And under creation of a livable and sustainable community, throughout our conversations, we found that there was a perception of crime that happened on Columbia Transit. And when we actually looked at the data, we found very, very low incidence of crime that has actually happened. So we took a look through the literature and found that there are environmental variables that could potentially influence crime. So we recommend auditing current bus stops to determine if they're near undesirable locations, such as liquor stores or abandoned buildings, things of that nature. Under bus and bus stop characteristics, we recommend creating an adoptive bus stop program. It could be with volunteers to address undesirable conditions around bus stops. So this could be lighting or a litter. And we also want to solicit feedback about perceived safety from transit user focus groups and incorporate that into training for the bus drivers. And then specifically under social capital, we recommend promoting a partnership between Columbia Transit and the Community Development Department to review zoning procedures that would promote transit-oriented developments along transit corridors. And then our last recommendation is to create a task force to research regulations to promote active transportation in Central Columbia. So specifically looking at streets that are closed off to cars or one-way streets potentially. In conclusion, our HA discovered positive health impacts that are linked with expanded transit services. And based on weighing this evidence, these impacts are likely to occur with transit expansion. At this point, we do not know the magnitude of transit expansion, so it is a little bit difficult to actually quantify some of the results. Other HAs that have been performed looked at a specific bus route or a light rail route that was going to be actually built. So it was a little bit easier for them to actually get some of that harder data. So we'd like to go ahead and open it up for questions.
Questions from council? Thank you very much.
I wanted to give other people an opportunity. Well, thank you for your work and for the results. And I understand from what you just said that you couldn't analyze the exact impact of transit, not knowing exactly how Columbia, we want to expand the bus service and improve the bus service, but there isn't anything specific in the next year or two. We've been making efforts for you to analyze. So I guess my question is, I understand you have an additional HIA grant to do follow-up work?
That's correct. We still have funding through September 30th of this year to perform a second HIA.
So I guess what I'm wondering is if you could look at the impact of a method of funding in expanding and improving transit. Specifically, one of the things we've considered is a utility fee. You know, we're working on the student fee route, but would that be possible, and what could you do with that?
With the time frame, since we are a little bit limited, it would have to be a rapid HA, which this particular HA that we conduct is an intermediate. It's a little bit longer. It gives us a little bit more time to actually go out and get primary data. The one we would have to perform this year would be called a rapid HA, so it would be a lot shorter. We wouldn't have as much time to go out and collect primary data, so we'd be able to do some literature reviews, maybe talk with transit or members of council on what they would actually like to see researched as far as how the utility fee would impact citizens in Columbia.
But the work that we've done could feed into that. So there's a lot of what we found that we could make more specific if we had, for example, a more specific funding mechanism, so we would have an idea of a dollar amount. We would then know how much services could be expanded. So I think, yeah, there would be opportunity for what we've done to be the foundation for a more specific.
And you could look at whether a utility fee had a different impact on different populations.
Right.
And
correct.
Now, you mentioned that this is one of the early, this is a less common to do this kind of study than in other countries. So I don't know if you have comparable health impact studies from other U.S. cities to look at. And I'm just curious, is this done more in developing countries where aid is targeted, or is this done more in Europe? Where
It's primarily done more in Europe and Asia, but it's more mandated there. Uh-huh. Whereas here, it's particularly usually grant funded for the most part. There have been over 200 done in the U.S. and about 150 done alone since 2008. And many of them have been done on transit systems, specifically on the coast. So there is some sort of precedent to also look at as well.
There would be some advantage of doing what you call the FAST study to do the literature review and compare ourselves to other cities. I think that would be interesting and useful. I think that's a question.
Is there a way to try to get our arms around the number of employers that run late night shifts and how many people would ride the bus if the service was offered? I mean, we can run a bus till 3 a.m. mm-hmm. and maybe pick up one person, but I'm trying to figure out a way to pull those employers who offer those late night shifts and see if they can talk to their employees and see the potential of ridership on the bus. And if the potential is high enough, you know, maybe we'd expand the service.
Absolutely, and that might just be a good place to start with some of the bigger employers or some of the companies that have shift workers, and just kind of get their response and see what they would have to think about that.
It seems to me that'd be a very limited number of ones that run late night shifts way up into the morning. I mean, past midnight or way in the morning. And mm-hmm. even during the first 3 days of the week when we cut off service earlier, even up into the evening on those particular routes. So maybe that could be part of your next study, is try to figure out what the potential of the ridership could be.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
For those people getting back and forth to work.
Good.
You know, most doctors' offices aren't open at night, and mm-hmm. A lot of grocery stores are closed after 10 o'clock, but there are some all-night shoppers, you know, in grocery stores too. So it seems like to me it might be possible to do some polling and get that data.
Well, thank you for this. You know, they've described the system we sort of aspire to. You've all described it as well on many occasions. This gives some specific examples and ideas on the table, so that's pretty helpful. Obviously, we have a budget challenge there, so all of this will be in context of what we can manage. But really good work. Thank you for that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Our Grace. So we'll transition now, and Margrace will lead us through. It is that time of year where we begin our annual process of meeting and conferring with represented labor groups, and I like to think that we have a pretty good conversation throughout the year, and certainly we've added some more specificity to it. Last year we sort of laid out time frames that seemed to work for everyone, and so that's been a nice improvement. And so at the beginning of the process, we like to have all of our groups come deliver to council their thinking for the coming year. Margrace.
This is the second year that we've started the process earlier in the year so that we could more ably tie it into the budget process. As you know, Chapter 19-25 outlines our process and our calendar for our meet and confer process with our recognized groups. Our groups were contacted in January and asked to submit their issues or interests to us, and you saw, I think, in the council agenda packet the information that we received. Tonight we have two groups here, I think, that are going to speak to you. We have Local 1055 of the International Association of Firefighters, and we have Local 773 of Laborers International Union of North America. And because Steve was here first, he's going to get to go first in a minute. Our initial meetings with all of the groups that want to sit down and talk are scheduled we will be scheduling those later this month, and we'll hold them as necessary through about May and bring information to you later about what we've found. And as you know, the management team includes me, Kavanaugh, Nose, and the appropriate department heads for each of the groups. So Steve Forrest is the current president of 1055 Local, the IAFF, and he will come and talk to you first. Steve, you're welcome.
Mayor, council members, my name is Steve Forrest. I am president of Columbia Professional Firefighters. Since 2009, the only monetary item that we have asked for representing our members is to restore staffing to a level where Engine 2, located at 1212 Worley Street, will be fully staffed. What a difference a grant makes. I want to thank Fire Chief Chuck Witt and his staff for their persistent efforts in securing a Safer Act grant for five additional firefighters. I also want to thank City Manager Mike Mathis and each of you for your roles that you played to acquire these grant dollars. Our members realize and understand the long-term financial commitment associated with accepting these grants. Meet and confer process gives us an opportunity to improve the level of service we provide to the community and makes the Columbia Fire Department a better place to work. This would not be possible without the cooperation of Margaret Buckler and her staff, and we want to thank her. Thank you. Our goals and objectives for 2004. Item number one, we respectfully ask that we allow three employees per day to be allowed on vacation. In the past, we've had two people off every day. We'd like to up that to three. Item number two, which is not really listed as an item we're asking for at this point, it's an issue. Pay compression remains an issue. Our members understand the challenges that the Fire Chief Witt and his staff currently face. Together, we are working very hard on a restructuring plan to solve our own compression problem. It's premature at this point to ask for a definitive monetary value to help resolve this issue. We're working very closely. The grant kind of took an item off our list to ask for, so at this time, I just want to say Chuck and I are working very close, and in the future, we may come back and we'll have something for you that's a little more definitive. We are going to start at the bottom for our lowest paid firefighters and hopefully work up from there. We want to start with those guys. On behalf of the men and women of the Columbia Professional Firefighters, thank you for considering this year's request, and I look forward to discussing it with you in the future. Thank you.
Any questions of Mr. Forrest from the council?
Thank you, Forrest. Thank you, Steve. Local 773, Laborers International Union of North America, Paul Prendergast is going to talk to you. He's an attorney for that group. And take it away, Paul.
Thank you very much. And thank you for having me here this evening. I appreciate the opportunity to discuss our proposal with you. Hopefully you all have it in your packet of material, our initial proposal. And we'll start off with wages. And we understand the financial situation at this time and for some time what it's been like. But the proposal that we have is for a modest 50-cent-an-hour increase. And when you factor in that the CPI is currently at 1.7% for Missouri households, in October of 2011, there was a 19-cent increase in city water fees. The medical increase, premium increase of $27.24 a month was effective January of 2012. Overall, the employee's income has shrunk 21% since 2008. This is just trying to get a little bit of catch-up. It's not going to get us all the way there. We understand that can't be done all at once. But we believe that that's a modest proposal to try to even things out a little bit. We have some issues concerning the labor contract finalization. We would like the labor contract to authorize, or excuse me, to be recognized as a collective bargaining agreement. We believe that's what it is. I believe we've had this this discussion before, but since that time, there's been another Missouri Supreme Court case, Ledbetter, which imposes a duty of good faith in the collective bargaining, and frankly points the way to do that to the federal rules, what the National Labor Relations Board does. And the we think that would be a good way to do things. We don't think it would cost the city anything. It's how we're going to get along together, how we're going to, what responsibilities we have, what things we can and can't do, what things that the city can and can't do. And it would govern our relationship, and I believe that that would be a very good thing, and it would improve employer-employee relationship. In that vein, I think that it's important that the contract, that it be recognized as a contract binding on all parties. It's only fair that when the city requires the employees to follow these rules that are set up in the contract and in the various policies, that the city itself be willing to be bound by what it says it will do. These contracts are only for a year, so it's not as if there's an onerous burden upon the city if the financial condition should change that rapidly. And frankly, if that does happen, we have always been willing to sit down and talk if we see that there is such a situation. So I think that if we look at it in that context and in basic fundamental fairness, it would seem to be the right thing to do. We believe that the form that we have submitted, I know the city is looking at doing it as an ordinance, we've submitted a form ordinance for that which would provide signature lines. And would, I think last year we had proposed to include many of the policies into the contract. That was pretty voluminous, and we have pared that down and would refer to them by the ordinance numbers and have those included. Moving along to the number three of our proposal, occupational injury leave, workers' compensation. Excuse me. Currently, if an employee is injured on the job and they need to see somebody from the city occupational health or a provider, and they go to see them that day, the day of the injury, they're compensated for that. When they leave work, they're paid for those for the time that they go there. But if it can't be scheduled that day, they have to go, say, their next day or another working day, and they go, they're not paid for the time that they're visiting or going to see this city occupational health or the medical provider. And we believe that that's just not right, that I don't think that's what the city really intends. And I think many of the departments do compensate, do go ahead and pay the employee for that time missed, but I don't believe that it's universally applied. And we think that, it again, as fundamental fairness, that all of the departments be treated the same way, that those employees be paid for the time that they're seeing these professionals based on a work-related injury. So I think that's fairly self-explanatory. Next, on number four, the tool allowance. Currently, it's $500 per year. That doesn't nearly cover what the employees have to spend out of their own pocket to buy the tools to do the city's work. And we're asking an increase to $1,500 per year. There are 17 mechanics, so the increase, the cost would be $17,000. But we believe that is, again, it's very fair because this is money that's coming out of their pocket. They're buying these tools on their own, and they're supplying them to the city they're using them for the city to perform work for the city. And again, we believe that that it's only fair that they be compensated for that. Next is
question on that.
Certainly.
So the employees have to supply some tools on their own. Like, and what kind of tools would those be?
Address that more specifically. Regina Guevara is the field representative for the
maintenance is required to have all their tools. Trucks. $500 has been given. Equipment, they need to do their job.
And they determine what tools they need, and they're not purchased in mass, like I would think.
I don't think they're purchased in mass. It comes, new supplies come. They're required to buy their own tools, and $500 a year does not cost to keep up with the technology.
And they don't submit a receipt. They just automatically get the 500, and then whatever they need has to come out of the 500. Is that how it works?
No, they're not automatically given 500. They're given up to $500.
They do have to show a
receipt. So there has to be some kind of reimbursement, yes, receipts.
What should the number be? What would you recommend for?
We're requesting 1,500.
1,500, okay.
And just a little anecdote, I suppose. My son is a mechanic, just started working as a mechanic, and I was shocked when he told me he has to supply his own tools. He works for a bus company and repairs school buses. And he spent about $5,000 just to get the tools that he needs to be able to work on the school buses. And it's a continuing process of acquiring tools. So it is a very expensive proposition.
Then he owns the tools and not the city.
That's correct. He owns the tools. This actually relieves the city of the requirement to buy all these sets of tools to have in the shop for the mechanics to use. Instead, the mechanics come in with their own tools, and they do that. And they have to insure those tools. You know, if a tool gets stolen from them, someone borrows a tool, doesn't put it back, they're on the line for that tool. They've got to buy, if they want another one, they got to buy it. And if they need to have those tools, if they're going to perform the work that the city requires them to work, if they don't have the tool, they can't do the work. So kind of required to do it.
I would say on average, a toolbox of a mechanic is probably in the realm of $25,000.
Add everything up. Okay. The toolbox itself might be $1,500, $2,000. Box. Thank you very much. That really wraps up the specific proposals that we have. I'd be more than happy to answer any other questions concerning anything we've discussed here this evening.
On your first bullet point here, you said all union eligible employees. Can you define that for me?
I'm sorry, sir?
On your first point about the 50-cent an hour raise?
Yes.
It says all union-eligible employees. Can you define that for me?
Those are employees within the bargaining unit that we represent who are not management or confidential employees, supervisory personnel.
Are they dues-paying employees?
No, not all of them, no.
But you consider them union-eligible?
No, they are union-eligible employees. They're eligible to become to be union members because they're not a confidential employee or a supervisor, and they are in a bargaining unit that we represent.
Of these people you represent, how many pay union dues?
I don't have that figure.
Roughly. And how many don't?
There's about 250.
60 pay dues. And the 250 are all here?
Parks and Rec, Public Works, and
Power Plant.
So this, but they are union eligible, is what you're saying?
They're in our bargaining unit, so.
So if they got the increase, what would happen? Do they pay you a fee of some kind?
No.
No.
Okay.
By law, we have to give them fair representation.
Whether they pay dues or not.
Voluntary.
Right, we can't just request that only the union members receive the increases or the union members get the benefit of one proposal or another. We're required to represent all of those individuals who are in that bargaining unit.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Just summarize the main points and the reasons for the shift transition pay request.
Thank you, and I omitted that one when in my and I Regina reminded me, and I believe that comes into play as it was explained to me. For instance, there's a snow day, there are two separate shifts, and if the one shift has to come in and plow snow for 8, 10, 12 hours, then they have a rest period where they before they can come back on the next shift. What that effectively does is, if they take that time off, and want to be paid for it, they have to take paid time off, which means that they don't get overtime. Those hours wouldn't be calculated for overtime. And so, really, what ends up happening is that, you know, your employees come out for you in an emergency, work their butts off for 8, 10, 12 hours plowing the snow. And then they're effectively prevented from getting any overtime for it. And what this would do would be to consider that as hours worked, and it would pay for those hours off, and it would be considered as hours worked in calculating overtime. And that is something that would cost some money, obviously. It would be restricted, of course, to the situation to like emergency situation with snow plowing, for instance. But again, you've got employees who are going the extra mile, coming out when nobody else is coming out and doing the work to clear the streets for everybody in the city. And then, sorry guys, you can't have any overtime for it. So this would address that.
Our shifts. But we're asking for that transition pay for. It's also common practice for Boone County. Looked at just something. County's practices are this.
And they transition off the 12 hours back to the regular shift.
And that's a standard approach for municipal workers around the country, would you say?
We believe so, yes, in our experience.
Getting back to, kind of cycling back to the tools, do you have any data on what cities normally provide for tool payment, what the range would be?
Exactly. And I don't have that with me, but I can certainly get that information and provide it to the council so you have some barometer to look
I'd
at.
Love to have that as a benchmark.
Absolutely, sure. Right.
Any other questions of Mr. Prendergast?
I have one question. Would you have been satisfied with last year's meet and confer if the same agreement had been a signed contract? Is that the only difference?
That is a major, major difference. And that would have gone a long way towards resolving it. The money situation last year, we understood, and we felt it was a fair amount that was able to do there. That's well it in a nutshell.
No, are we answering your question? Are we satisfied with the way that meet and confer goes?
No, I just wondered if overall, I understand that you want to end up with a signed contract, and the meet and confer process doesn't allow for that. But the agreement that you reached, was it substantially the same as what you would have liked to have seen in a signed contract? The content of what resulted?
More or less, but I think what Regina was getting to, I think, and I'm not sure if it was the question you were asking, was the process itself, and were we are we satisfied with the meet and confer process? And with that, I would have to say no, and I would point again to the Ledbetter case, which refuses to say courts below had imposed a set of rules on them, and they said, no, you can't do that. The Supreme Court said the entity should make its own rules. But they basically all the time were pointing at the National Labor Relations Board and the federal ruling of the federal courts and the labor board deals with things. And again, that gives us a framework to work with each other. And for instance, I think one thing that was discussed in the case was meet and confer is not good faith in meet and confer is not sit down with the union, listen to what they have to say, and then do what you were going to do anyway. That's not good faith. Good faith is when there is exchange back and forth, there are counter proposals, and an honest, you go in hoping to get an agreement. In fact, if I could just have a second here, the first page of the opinion, and it says, because Article 1, Section 29 of the Missouri Constitution provides that all employees, public and private, have a right to organize and to bargain collectively, it necessarily requires that the board to meet and confer with the union in good faith with the present intention to reach an agreement. Now, there's a lot more in there. That's a synopsis of the opinion of, but that's what we think is kind of been missing. We have felt, whether it's true or not, we have felt that we meet and confer, but we say what we want, and then we're told what's going to happen. And we understand that you can't be forced to agree to anything, as we feel that we should not be forced to agree, which is I think how we felt it has been happening, because these we say, well, here it is. This is what we're going to do. I think you would find that if we have an actual collective bargaining, actual negotiations, I think we will find agreement because we do all the time when there are differences as far as what could be, what we think could be provided economically or how a grievance procedure should be or how something else should be. We always find agreement. In 4 years of doing this with 773, with 150 different bargaining units, I have yet to go to what's called interest arbitration. I have yet to go to an arbitrator to say, help us solve this contract because we couldn't do it ourselves. We've always done it. And I think that we can do this. We recognize the challenges that the city faces. We want to work with the city to conquer those challenges and to move forward. And we would like to do that hand in hand. And I'm not just saying let's just sing kumbaya. I really mean that. I think that it we're much stronger when we all work together. So I'll get off my soapbox now. And
I'd like to add something. I've been the fielder for 6 years, and I don't get to speak as much as I'd like. And what I think the missing component is that we'd have never been able to do counter proposals. We've always, my first experience here was horrible. And we have done so much better over the years. But because we don't have a contract that really says how we're going to play and go forward, we don't have the ability to really make any substantial changes throughout the year. And I think that because we go to this meet and confer process, at the end, for the last 3 years, we've never had a summary or a finalization of what we've agreed to. And back to the contract, we have not been satisfied over these years as to the progress that we've made. In 2008, we started this process. In 2010, we thought it was complete. In 2011, the attorney gives us a form that took all the language we worked on for so long. We are now in 2012, and we still can't agree on the language that goes into this. For me, it's very frustrating because we come every year, and this is the first year, and I really appreciate the questions that we're getting because this is the first year that someone actually cared enough to ask. Because we come, and we get about 5 minutes of a presentation, and we go home, and then we
meet with the directors and Mark Grace, and, you know, at the end, it's really, at the end of the day, it's the city manager's recommendation that comes to you, and you guys, you know, approve or deny that. Well, that's not a fair process. You guys approve and deny it. He gets to put the recommendation in, and, you know, with all respect to the city manager, he doesn't participate in it. So we have a real hard time when we get here trying to figure out what are we going to get in return by coming and really telling you how we feel, because the recommendations that, you know, we put in all of the negotiation, we call them negotiation, you call them confer, the negotiations that we put forward doesn't really get to you to vote. The
Supreme Court calls it collective bargaining.
Yeah. So that's why we really are here to hit home. That's the heart and soul of what we're doing. We want a collective bargaining agreement, and I think the workers deserve that. And, you know, if we make any progress this year, I hope it's towards a collective bargaining agreement that we can sign.
I have a question for Mark Grace. Am I dreaming, or do we have a year back in 10 or 11 where we had a reduction in medical costs?
We had a year this year where we didn't have an increase.
Wasn't there a reduction in 10 or 11?
In my life, we haven't had a reduction.
I remember seeing the numbers go down.
We've had in different categories, yeah, but we haven't had a reduction. We've had 2 years, not consecutive, where we did not increase our premiums.
The obvious problem is we have no idea what medical costs are going to do over the next three or four years.
No, sir, we do not.
I mean, it could be a substantial shock.
We have a task force that's just getting ready to start meeting about what to do about 2014 with the new health care reform.
Any other questions?
In the interest of time, I'll just lay out where we go from here. One of the things that I respectfully disagree about is the process, and it is now enshrined in ordinance, and so we have one that's knowable, it's laid out, we have sort of time frames laid out there. So the council will have a closed session where we'll talk more about this, where you can provide direction to me, council. And then I do participate. I'm not at many of the meetings you're in, Regina, and that's for sure. But believe me, we'd have many conversations on the management side of the table, so to speak. And that process plays out where we receive, we analyze, we give back. So it is a good faith conversation, and I would tell you that many of the things that have been asked for in the past are in fact in Chapter 19 today because there's good faith. Now, we can't always do everything, obviously, and we do disagree on some of the fundamentals, but I feel good about the process. I feel, you know, I've only been here 2 years, so you all have far more history on me than that, but I'm really pleased and proud of the work that staff's done on that, on the process.
And I could appreciate that, and I certainly don't want to, as far as the process, argue the good faith issue with you at this point. But one thing I will say on that, which I think is real important, it's hard for me to see good faith when the city's not wanting to be bound. How can that be good faith? All right, we're going to say we're going to do these things, but we really don't have to do it if we don't want to. To me, that is just the antithesis of good faith. I think that, for me personally, that's where really the rub comes in, because I just don't understand it.
Well, again, ordinance binds me pretty well. It's the law for staff. So that's as binding as you can get with staff.
But the ordinance, the city's position
your
is
point
that the ordinance
is,
can be changed at any time.
Right. The council
during
can,
the contract.
The council has the power to change, yes.
Well,
And I'll defend that, and I know why you would like it to be a contract. So, you know, we'll continue to have that conversation, and obviously there's a role for council in setting up what your policy decisions are, how you want to move forward. So please take the time to think about this. We'll schedule the meeting for you to give me input, formal input.
And I'd be happy to come back anytime and address any questions, concerns, or anything that council has.
Thank you. We'll take.
We are absent two of the groups this evening. CPOA has a new executive director, and he sent a short email, but I don't have any idea about presentation, and we have not received any information at all from IBEW. So just wanted you to know that.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Let's take a brief, let's take a 5-minute break, no more than that, and try to start rather promptly at 7 o'clock.
Hi there.